It's a real pleasure to welcome everybody here this evening. It's fantastic to see such a packed room after such a busy day at conference. I'm here just to welcome you to the lecture, and Doug will introduce Sharmi shortly. The Beckley Lecture has been going for nigh on 80 years now. It was set up originally by Mr. Beckley to run an annual lecture for thinking Methodists. So I'm really delighted to welcome you all here. The trust which he founded had two purposes: to run an annual lecture on issues that were of social and political concern of the day, and then to fund next year's lecture. So there is a bowl at the door. If after today's lecture you would like to make a donation to enable us to run a lecture next year, that would be wonderful. But it's a great pleasure to invite you all here. I'd like to introduce Doug Swanee, who's the Connectional Secretary for Methodist Church, who's going to be chairing this evening's lecture. Thank you, Doug.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Vice President. It's very kind of you to hand over to me. It's wonderful to have all of you here tonight. Sharmi has commented that she's surprised on such a beautiful evening, the first beautiful summer's evening, that you're packed in here. I've also assured her, though, that your questions at the end are going to be insightful and razor sharp, probing and engaging. So I'm leaving that one with you. We're really pleased to have Sharmi with us this evening. If you're anything like me, you'll know Sharmi best from Question Time. And I'm fascinated by Question Time on a weekly basis. And it's always a highlight for me when it's announced you're going to be on, and there's going to be, I know, some real engagement with some of the issues that are facing our country. If you have already read Sharmi's book, you'll know a lot about her, that she's really poured out into that book. If you haven't already bought her book, you can do so at the end, and I'm assured you'll be very happy to sign copies of that book. The book takes us through some of your journey from being a barrister at the Home Office, the constant references to the Home Office as the Dark Tower or Mordor, I particularly liked. But of course, most of us know you best for your work at Liberty as its director, and doing some very influential work there over the last few years in terms of engagement and the whole conversation about civil liberties and human rights and how all that plays out in our country today. I read the book recently when I was on holiday, really just in an attempt to try and expense my holiday. Turns out I wasn't allowed to do that. But what happened to me is, as I read the book, the topics of conversation at the dinner table every single night didn't really go, I think, where my holiday companions thought we were going to be chatting about. But I really do recommend that you have a look at it. Some of the comments about you I've just reveled in. Britain's most dangerous woman. It's fantastic. The most effective public affairs lobbyist of the past 20 years. And of course, you've just been involved in all the work in the Labour Party, 2 months of your time looking into anti-Semitism there. We're really so honoured that you're here tonight. We're really looking forward to hearing you engaging with us, and we're looking forward to be able to ask some questions. So I'm now going to hand over to you, Sharmi. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Doug, for that incredibly warm and kind welcome, which I think we all need in these difficult times, do we not? It'll be no surprise to you to know that I accepted this wonderful invitation a long time ago, and I agreed to come and speak about liberty, conscience and belief. I thought that I would really concentrate on chapter 6 of my book that's already been advertised at the back, which I called Rubbing Along Together, which was all about freedom of thought, conscience and religion and identity, and how really I think the struggle for democracy in what is now the United Kingdom cannot be separated historically from the struggle for religious freedom. And we all know the quotes about, you know, the role of Methodists like you in social progress. We know the Tony Benn quotes, etc. I think a little bit more Methodism and a little bit less of the shouty stuff would probably be very welcome right now. And that's all I'm qualified to. I'm not even qualified to say that, so I will be quiet about that. I didn't expect to come here at this particular moment in our country's history, and to be on any kind of public platform at a moment like this feels like an incredible responsibility, which I will try to discharge as well as I can, and briefly before we perhaps can begin the conversation. But yes, of course, be afraid, be very afraid, because you're quite right to say, Doug, that I was once called the most dangerous woman in Britain by that great British institution, the Sun newspaper. And of course, one could write an entire book about the reception that you get when you introduce yourself in that way in different parts of the country. One of the wonderful privileges of having been a human rights activist for over 14 years has been the privilege of going to speak and engage with different people, young and old, people of all faiths, no faith, lawyers, non-lawyers, recovering lawyers like me. As you never recover, you're only ever in remission in my experience. They drag you back in, have an inquiry, all right then. But mine didn't take 150 years, just 2 months. So you go up and down the country trying to engage with people talking about the importance of our fundamental rights and freedoms, and you want an icebreaker, do you not? You all speak publicly. It's part of your mission, I have no doubt. You want an icebreaker. Be afraid, be very afraid, I say. The Sun newspaper once called me the most dangerous woman in Britain. And goodness me, the different responses in different parts of the country. In some places you get just a very gentle titter. Perhaps, you know, that's been on the breakfast table this morning. I once spoke in Derry, Londonderry, that is the correct description. I was invited by the British Council. Why me? Why Derry, Londonderry? Why the British Council? What was that all about? It was at the height of the War on Terror, the misnamed, misjudged War on Terror that will be all over the news tomorrow. And I was asked to go and speak. It's many years ago now, because I'm a very old lady. Botox is amazing. No. It's not true. No. It's good genes. It's my mother's genes. And I went to speak in Derry, Londonderry about the War on Terror. And I very foolishly began, be afraid, be very afraid. Most dangerous woman in Britain. Not a giggle. Not a single giggle. And I thought, okay, Shami, that was slightly misjudged, wasn't it? Gave my talk, didn't touch on the Troubles, just stuck to the War on Terror and the way that our rights and freedoms were going to hell in a handcart, ID cards, internments, extraordinary rendition, which, by the way, was not beautiful singing or wall plastering. The power of language, very important. The power of words and euphemisms to disguise the truly unspeakable and make them acceptable. That's what Orwell's really about. When you're a human rights activist, I learned early on, you do not use certain adjectives because people stop listening to you. One is Orwellian, another is Kafkaesque. Because if you start using them, you just keep on using them. It's like crack cocaine, you just don't want to go there. And then people will stop listening to you because everything is Orwellian, it's Kafkaesque. And it's about time, isn't it, that there was an adjective like that named for a woman? Because apparently Dickensian is not Emily Dickinson, it's somebody else. So we'll have answers on a postcard, please, about the adjective named for a female writer. But yeah, all the euphemisms, the abuse of language. Orwellian, to me, is not about how many CCTV cameras you have in your street, though there's probably too many. Orwellian, to me, is ultimately about that great essay, Politics and the English Language, the way in which the abuse of language can lead to the contortion of ideas and values and ultimately the abuse of people. And perhaps we're going to read a little about that in the next few days. We're going to read millions of words, apparently, more than War and Peace, for those who have the time and the energy so to do. But I was in Derry, Londonderry, remember? That's where I left you before your little nap. I was in Derry, Londonderry, going, be afraid, be very afraid. And I talked about all these things that were happening in our name during the War on Terror. And at the end of the lecture, I was taken to a very smart reception in the Guildhall in Derry, Londonderry. And a woman, an immaculately dressed woman of a certain age in a sharp suit, came up to me, beautifully made up, a pillar of the local establishment. And forgive me, because I can't do impressions. They only said you were the most dangerous woman in Britain. I really was. It's funnier now than it was in the moment. Was transported back to primary school, the swotty Asian girl in northwest London and behind the bike sheds and the woman in question had been convicted of conspiracies to cause explosions in the mainland. She'd done many years in prison, but here's the thing: this isn't just an extended joke. I know it feels like it at the moment, but this woman was now working in the Stormont Parliament and was responsible for policing. And I say that to you because these are difficult times. I want to remind you that out of the darkness, light can come. Because when I was a kid growing up, quite a political kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, I did not believe that I would live to see the fall of the Berlin Wall. I did not believe that I would live to see liberation in apartheid South Africa. I did not believe that I would live to see relative peace in Northern Ireland. Okay, recent times have not been as great as though, you know, there was that golden patch, that purple patch in the 90s when all these things seemed to happen. I know that the recent months, even since I stopped being Director of Liberty, even since I started this little summer job on a 0 hours contract for the Labour Party. Thank you, Mr. Corbyn. These have not been easy times. But I just want to say to you, I still have hope. And my hope comes from being in rooms like this one. My hope comes from other people. Some Christians call it fellowship. Some people to the left of politics call it solidarity. There are other words in other languages for it. In the intimate sphere, we call it family, friendship, love. But we are social creatures. And we're wonderful, beautiful individuals, but we are also social creatures. And we don't always get it right, but I think we'll do better in the future, please. Particularly because of my hope in the young. So yes, the most dangerous woman in Britain. And I was feeling really quite cocky about that, as you can imagine, dining out on this around the country. When you go to the great city of Liverpool, by the way, and say, be afraid, be very afraid, some newspaper once called me, you know, you get a standing ovation. That's it. That's your speech. Just stand there. And serious point to go with the funny. God bless those Hillsborough families. Yeah. All those years. And that is a cause of optimism too. And that is a combination of campaigning and activism and ultimately the rule of law. These things come together. We can use these things and they ultimately got some kind of vindication for what really happened in Liverpool. Hillsborough families, Hillsborough mums, credit to them. And then my final dangerous woman point, before I give up on this little riff, is that given that this had been working out so well for me, imagine my horror over a year ago now, in the run-up to the 2015 general election, when that other great media institution of our country, the Daily Mail newspaper, decided that I was no longer worthy of the title. And decided that I was no longer the most dangerous woman in Britain, and that title had now been won by a charismatic politician north of the border. And you know what? To add insult to injury, the First Minister of Scotland is a little bit younger than me as well. Yeah. So all things come to an end, and I decided to hang up my my megaphone and my microphone, and you know, not be director of Liberty anymore, and that was all good. And I was going to have at least a gap year, surely, or if not the summer job. And then on the 29th of April of this year, the call came. We've got this little problem in the Labour Party, really. Hadn't noticed. and that too has been an enormous challenge, enormous privilege, enormous challenge. I have listened to people's experience and people's pain and people's mutual distrust and all the rest of it. And I think I've learned so much about the importance of listening before there can be progress, before there can be healing. And I think in your movement and in your church, you'll probably have some degree of sympathy with that, if only there was more of it in our politics and in our country, particularly at this difficult time. So I was invited here to talk about faith and conscience, and I want to do that, but I want to also do it now in the moment in which we're in, because I don't think that we can separate these issues from broader issues of tolerance, of understanding, of identity in this moment. Since I was commissioned to write my report for the Labour Party about its own local difficulties, I witnessed the murder of a wonderful young idealistic Member of Parliament. We Brexited, and both major political parties are effectively in crisis. And the crisis is deeper and broader, I believe. You hear about it every day. You hear about it affecting families and communities, and this evening I heard from someone that it's even in the church. So something is going on that we need to address. We need to address it intellectually and politically, but also in our hearts. Because I talked about what it feels like, to me at least, I can't pontificate about other people, to be a human being is, in my mind, to be a creature of faith and logic, emotion and reason. We are not robots, and we are not other creatures that don't have logic and intellect. We have both parts of our essence, and this is relevant, in my view, to the whole issue of human rights and faith, democracy and faith, but it's also relevant to this deeper, broader question about how we rub along together in this incredibly challenging, shrinking, interconnected world of ours. Now, I talk about this a little bit in chat. Don't read it. You can read it. It's very short. He read it. He's got sun lotion on his copy. He read it on his cruise. My 14-year-old son calls it a short book with large font. So great intellectuals like you, Method, you're not going to be troubled, but it's not going to keep you up too late. But if it's too long, then just read chapter 6. It's called Rubbing Along Together, and it's the chapter where I try to grapple with these issues of faith and human rights and difference and refugees and identity and so on. I just want to share a couple of thoughts with you that were my thoughts when I wrote this book before recent events. But I've looked again, I've read many times today to see if I still stand by it, and I think I do. So before I go to the faith space, I want to talk about the broader issue of identity, because this is I think relevant, not just to faith and differences of faith, but to broader issues in this malaise affecting this country and Europe and the broader world at the moment, and to questions of tolerance and liberal democracy, and where we stand about all of that. Now, I'm just going to play a game with you, and just play along with me. My suggestion for this moment is that there are two choices when it comes to identity. Not 3.5, not 15, not 97.8 recurring, just two. Now that's very dogmatic of a bleeding heart liberal like me, but let's just play along, right? It's a parlour game. Are we going to do this? Okay. There's two choices when it comes to how to approach this issue of identity. The first option is what I call the military checkpoint option. Imagine a military checkpoint, and they exist in many places in the world, and if some people have their way, they will exist again in places where they have not existed for some time. And shame on them for not considering that in recent months, but anyway. We know the model of a military checkpoint. You go to the checkpoint, and the question is, are you allowed to pass? And you don't make that choice. Somebody else makes that choice for you. And they demand your papers. That's a state or a police officer or a military official. Somebody looks at you and looks you up and down and looks at your papers and decides what your identity is. And consequences flow from that which you have no control over. Maybe you will be stopped and searched, maybe you will be strip searched, but somebody, potentially an armed person, is going to decide, do you pass or do you not? It's an identity check of the most obvious and authoritarian kind, and it makes you feel anxious, makes you feel chippy and defensive. And maybe when you're feeling chippy and defensive, you look more suspicious and hostile as a result, yes? And this is a vicious circle that in the broader flow of history and life tends not to end well, in my experience. Consequences flow and somebody else decides, do you pass or do you not? That is the military checkpoint version of identity politics. Guess what, from the way I'm caricaturing it, I don't like it very much. So let's go to option two. Now I know that I'm in danger of being ridiculed for this option, but I'm going to go, this is the bourgeois liberal Chakrabarti, what does she know, option, right? Mary Poppins option. So we're not at the military checkpoint anymore of identity. We're still dealing with identity, but now we're at one of those, we're at the Beckley Metro and Westminster, and you might go to these kind of Tesco Centrals or, these, it's a cross between a convenience store and a supermarket. Yeah? It's sort of basket only, little shishi, urban supermarket. And you might not go there to do your entire weekly shop, but you might pop in there after work when you need a few items. And you've got your basket, and you're picking up a few items for supper or whatever it is you need. And maybe it's busy. And maybe one evening after work, there's a bit of a queue. And so I'm standing behind you in the queue in this little shishi urban supermarket. And I'm having a nose, and I'm having a look in your basket. And I'm making certain assumptions about you based on the basket. So you've got a bottle of champagne one evening. Are you posh? No. It's your mum's birthday, perhaps. But I might be making judgments about you. What food have you chosen? Have you chosen French cheese? Controversial. Or a microwavable curry? I don't know, to some people equally controversial, but the point I'm making is that you know, subject to the important economic constraints, you get to choose. And if you run out of cash at the checkpoint, you decide what is important, what's most important to you, what you leave in the basket and what you take out. And your basket could be different on any given evening. And I believe that to be closer to the reality of human experience. I believe multiple identity to be the actual truth about human identity. Some of us in this room are women. Some of us are Londoners. Many of us are Methodists. but the point is, which bit of your identity is the most important part at a particular moment will be affected by who you're with, what's just happened to you, what you're just about to do, and that's how it should be. And it should not be fixed by someone else, particularly down the barrel of a gun. That is my view. And I know sometimes in life there has to be a line in the sand and people have to choose which side they're on, but not too often, please. Not too often. Because victimhood is not a good place. And it produces some very bad results, in my view, for the victim, but also for the victims of the victim when that cycle continues. So that is my view of identity, and I rather prefer identity politics not to prosper. I prefer the... yes, you can joke at me with my little supermarket checkout, but isn't that the experience you'd rather have for yourself and your children than the military checkpoint? I believe most people in the world would prefer that. And now on to faith. So I'm not two options this time, because I'm feeling a little bit more liberal. So I'm going to posit three ways that one might look at this question of faith. You know, that Mr. Campbell apparently famously said, we don't do religion or something. Yeah, he said lots of things. And they all ended incredibly well. We don't do faith. So let's just talk about faith. Because you're here at your conference and you've been kind enough to invite me. I'm going to say there are three options now, being very liberal. Not 35 or 95.7 recurring, you understand, but three. I think the first option might be to pick your favourite one, which you kind of have by coming to this conference, and that's okay. Right? You pick your favourite one, but what you say is, in our country, in our society, this belief system will trump everything else to the point where it's embedded in the law of the land, it is the prevailing culture, and it is that way at the expense of everything else. An extreme example would be something like Afghanistan under the Taliban, right? And maybe a slightly less extreme example, but you know, even Britain at certain stages in its early history, right? The struggle for democracy was also the struggle for religious tolerance. I think we know this. Nothing else will be tolerated, one belief system only. Option number two is kind of the equal opposite. Faith is all dangerous, divisive, mumbo jumbo, nothing good can come of it. We don't do religion, right? Nothing good can come of it. It's all inquisitions and wars, etc., etc. I don't agree with that, by the way. Yes, there have been inquisitions and wars, but equally, amazing scientists and engineers helped design gas chambers and nuclear bombs. And the scientists, and you know, gave us penicillin, made our lives better and longer, and equally people of faith, as you know, have had a great role to play in progressive politics, in art, in altruism, in charity. My view is that human rights are about protecting the human being and the human condition. And as I said earlier, we are creatures of faith and reason, emotion and logic. Whether we're scientists or whether we are people of faith or of religious conviction or not. Someone who tells you that they're completely against the God delusion, for example, or anything like that, will still not be able to explain to you some of the most important decisions they've made in their life. Who they like, who they love, who they marry. What was that? That was a calculation or an algorithm? Actually, probably with these dating websites, it probably is. I'm too old for that stuff. And equally, people of faith do make calculations. Are scientists, you know, we are complex. We have both, and I think both need to be reflected. So this extreme anti-faith model of politics is troubling too. Extreme example, probably Stalin's Russia. More moderate example, I don't know, French Republic. And in the light of the inquiry that I've just finished for the Labour Party, some people have been upset about my comparisons between the experience of some people in the Jewish community and some people in the Muslim community. But I have to say that I think both communities have sometimes suffered with a certain allergy to faith on the left. And you can't completely separate modern racism from this allergy or even aversion to people of faith, and the suggestion that you might be of dubious loyalty, etc., etc., and your internationalism. All of these things are an issue, I believe, and I've said that, and some people are a little bit anxious about that, but I try to speak as I found. So guess what? From my characterisation of these two options so far, I support neither of them. So what is the third way? No, we don't talk about things as the third way. I think a human rights approach to faith and democracy in society gives faith neither a privileged nor a pariah status. And it recognises this complexity, this aspect of human identity and the multiple aspects of our identity. And it doesn't view that chasing faith into the private sphere, into the bedroom under the bed with naughty magazines, no. But nor does it seek to promote one faith over all others and to promote division and hatred between people. That's the Mary Poppins, Shami Chakrabarti potted version of all of this. And forgive me if it is naive, but it's pretty much all that I've got. And I know it doesn't give you magic solutions to all sorts of tensions when people disagree, and in particular when you're dealing with the great world religions, which have a certain vintage, if I can put it that way, and therefore have some, in many cases, some sort of patriarchal heritage that has to be dealt with, and there will be tensions between religious freedom at times and equal treatment and non-discrimination principles. That's for sure. That's for sure. But this is not a computer program. Human rights do not provide a computer program or a magic solution. They just provide a bit of a compass to help people navigate some minefields and some instincts that help us rub along together. Yes, we're entitled to our private and family life, but we're still not allowed to be cruel to our children. Yes, we're entitled to our conscience and our speech, but not to incite crimes against other people. Yes, there must be equal treatment, but not at the expense of a private space of conscience. If you don't want me, if somebody doesn't want me to be in their club or in their faith or in their clergy, that's their loss. But they are entitled to have their freedom of association, otherwise it's the end of freedom of conscience. And I would respect anybody's right to campaign for the end of the Human Rights Act, and they do. The end of the Equality Act, and they do. Of course they must be able to do that from any public platform or pulpit or Twitter feed. But when we have settled on a consensus in a democracy about human rights and equal treatment. I would ask people to broadly respect that and operate under that model, even if they want to challenge it and campaign for the end of it. As I say, it's not easy stuff. And there are difficult questions, you know, when people are, you know, civil registrars or even bakers. That was one of the hardest ones for me, the Baker case, you know. But as I say, it's not about whether we all agree. Sometimes it's actually about disagreeing well. And if that could have happened in our referendum campaign, some people would now feel less licensed to be really vile to each other on the underground and elsewhere. The art of disagreeing well and doing it in a certain kind of atmosphere of inclusion and tolerance, I think that that's really important. This wasn't designed to make us, you know, completely comfortable, but it was designed to keep us free. And if I dare a New Testament analogy instead, judge that you be not judged. And I think I've banged on for far too long, and it's time to have a conversation. But thank you so much for listening.